I've been going back to the theaters more, and I'm trying to make it like a habit when there's some kind of kid movie that's out in theaters, as long as it doesn't look entirely objectionable to me, like I'll just take him to go see it. And like yesterday after school, I picked him up and I surprised him and we went to the movies. We did the same thing last week. And oh my God, this is like just reinforcing why I want to do this miniseries, because like everything that he's seen basically prior to now has been largely cultivated and like curated by me and by Tani. And like occasionally we'll, you know, let him like kind of go off the reservation and watch something that's just like out because it's popular or something that he seems vaguely interested in. But for the most part, we've been pretty careful about what we're showing him and not just whatever is part of the slurry, the content slurry. And that's not the case if you just like want to casually reintroduce your child to the idea of going to the movies and just see what's out. And oh man, we saw Sonic 2 last week, and the drop off in quality from Sonic to Sonic 2 is roughly the drop off in quality from like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the 1990 feature film, right, to Ninja Turtles 2, which
is the Secret of the Ooze,
right, which is a steep and staggering drop off. And man, Sonic is like a perfectly mediocre movie that has like a couple of good performances and is kind of fun. And the second one is just hot dog shit. Like, well, what if it was 30 minutes longer and we added a bunch more lore and mythos, you know, because people really, what they responded to the first time was the deep well of Sonic the Hedgehog lore and the mythology.
That was definitely the most important part of the video game.
Right. Not that he's a silly character who runs fast.
Right.
Yeah.
No, definitely it was the lore and not like the clattering sound of dropping rings, right, or the fat guy in a hover ship.
Right. But then yesterday we saw, the fuck's it called? I forget the whole movie already. The Bad Guys.
What even is that?
It's a new DreamWorks CGI animated movie based on a series of like kids comic books. I refuse to call them graphic novels. They're for children. They're comic books. And it's like a crew of five animals who are the bad guys. And it's Wolf, voiced by Sam Rockwell. And he's like the cool leader of the crew. And they do heists and they rob banks and shit. And yeah, it's super stylish and looks amazing, and everything else about it is terrible and forgettable.
Speaking of Sam Rockwell,
yeah,
he's on Broadway right now.
He is.
He's in American Buffalo.
Right. Yeah.
Adrian and I are going to go see that in June.
That is
fucking stoked.
Mammoth's a difficult one now. It's hard to want to engage with any Mammoth at this point.
What happened with Mammoth?
9/11 broke him.
Okay.
And his politics have gotten crazier and crazier and crazier since then.
Awesome. We love it. You never remember who was canceled for what.
Yeah. Well, he's not even canceled, but
he just sucks.
This was on, what was this? It was on Fox recently. Here it is. Yeah. He was talking about the Don't Say Gay bill, and he said, "We have to take back control. If there's no community control of the schools, what we have is kids not only being indoctrinated, but groomed in a very real sense by people who are, whether they know it or not, sexual predators."
Oh, my God.
Yep. So congratulations, Jamie, because David Mamet is absolutely making money off those American Buffalo tickets.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yep. At least I got discounted tickets on Today Tix. God damn it. Whatever. Fuck it. You're not going to ruin my fun. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you who don't know shit about one or the other, my name is Jamie Harrison Rubin. I'm the wine guy.
I'm cutting out the part where you said your middle name and your last name. I am Scott. I am your movie guy, and we are here to help you. Each episode, we, James and I, pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we don't.
More often than not.
But we've got a new-ish, at this point, miniseries for you.
Ish. It's ish. This is part two of our latest ongoing, hopefully six-part miniseries, Parental Guidance. Suggested? Suggestions?
I like parental guidance suggestions. I think that...
But that's not a thing. Parental guidance suggested.
It's riffing on a thing. It's a riff on a thing.
No, but it's not a riff. I think just changing the punctuation and the cadence is good enough.
Sure.
And then putting a question mark at the end of it.
Because you like the image of you shrugging.
I mean, people imagine that for sure. They imagine little cartoon Muppet Me that Ross
made. Oh my God, can we get an image of cartoon you shrugging?
Well, the whole problem now is that we got that art and then released it into the world, and then immediately I shaved, and I've been clean shaven since then.
It's fine. Everyone thinks of you as having a beard.
Yeah, me too. So does my wife. So she puts a bag over my head. So does your son. Yeah, he's fine with it. He's gotten used to it. Anyway, part two of our latest miniseries, Parental Guidance Suggested. So my soon-to-be six-year-old son and I watch a lot of movies together, something I know that a lot of parents struggle to get their kids to do, either because in this 2022 hellscape world of tablets and video games and social medias and all the million other things that are competing for your kids' attention, it can be really difficult to get them to sit still for 90 minutes. Or because kids, mine included, mine especially, have this habit of getting stuck in a rut where they watch the same fucking movie over and over and over and over.
I mean, I remember doing that as a kid. I like wore down the videotape for Charlotte's Web.
Oh, sure.
To absolutely nothing.
Yeah. I mean, six-year-old me had RoboCop on a constant loop.
Jesus Christ.
A lot of damage was done. But yeah, so this miniseries is for the parents. It's for you out there, parents. I am recommending some favorites that are in regular rotation in my household, movies that are maybe slightly off the beaten path that I think you and your kids will enjoy, hopefully, together. Plus, if you hate my movie picks, Jamie is here, and Jamie will conceivably, responsibly help you get drunk while you supervise your child's entertainment.
I'm trying out here. Drink responsibly. You know, responsibly in a way that I don't drink,
right?
Which is irresponsibly.
Irresponsibly.
That's not true. I never drink and drive anymore.
Jamie, it's 11 in the morning and you have a glass of wine in front of you, okay? That's you have a problem.
This is work, Scott. We're doing work here.
Ain't nobody paying me.
That doesn't mean it's not work.
That is true.
So on the wine side of this particular miniseries, I chose Spain as my target, partly because I want to learn more about Spain, partly because I've been largely compelled by Spanish wines. And I love having, as you all know, counterpoints to the established narratives. And the established narrative in Spain is big extracted Tempranillo and also like whatever cava. And these are all wines that I find to be really interesting, generally low alcohol, generally sparkling white and rosé with one exception. And wines that I think go well with simple food that children tend to gravitate towards, so that you can all have an experience together, not pouring the wine for your kids, obviously, but, you know, so that you can engage with your kids on the movie and on the food that y'all are eating together.
We really do need that qualifier in every single episode, just to be clear.
Just to be very clear, do not put this wine in a sippy cup for your child.
The movie is for you and your child. The wine.
Right.
Just for the child. Also, if you don't have a kid.
The adult, Scott. Just for the adult.
Oh, did I say for the child?
You did. You said the wine is just for the child.
Well, not this one. This one is gross. Put this in a fucking straw cup and see what happens.
I can't argue with you. I like it a lot, but there are a lot of people out there who aren't.
Yeah.
This is for the natty boys.
Also, these movies, not just for the kids, by the way, because I watched one of the ones we'll be discussing in today's doubleheader recording session by myself last night and had a great time with it. And I loved all of these movies, or most of them I had seen before I was even a parent. So like anybody can enjoy the movies.
For sure.
But especially with the chillins, I think there's some value.
I think there's a lot of value.
But so, yeah, we're doing double features this miniseries. And for each double feature episode, Jamie had to pick one bottle to pair with the descriptors that I provided him for both movies. And at the end of the episode, we're going to find out, or we will arbitrarily determine, if his selection goes well with one, both, or neither of the wines. Movies. Fuck. One, both, or neither of the movies. So today we are, this one's really fun. Today we're talking about two George Miller sequels. George Miller, the Australian gonzo mastermind behind, among other things, the entire Mad Max series, took a, you know, occasional digression in the 90s and early aughts into making children's films. And so today we're talking about his weirdo sequels. The first is Babe, Pig in the City, the 1998 sequel to the beloved Babe, and Happy Feet 2, the 2011 sequel to 2006's Happy Feet. James, I told you that both of these movies were gonzo, hyperkinetic, transcendent. You can feel the seams, or they have rough edges, that they're both bold and fruit forward in their flavors.
Well, first of all, my name is Jamie and not James. And second of all, the wine that we are enjoying today is Partida Creus SP, or Subirat Parant. This is the 2020 vintage. If you're interested in acquiring a bottle, it's available at despagnafinewines.com for $32. This wine comes to us from Catalunya in Spain.
I am tasting this one blind today. I have not opened the bottle previously. Last week's episode, I did that, which is not normally my preference, and it kind of worked out well, probably because my palate and tasting mechanism are far more refined than they were when we began this project several ages of Middle Earth ago.
Oh, yeah. Listening to us on the rerun episodes,
it was like, go through rough.
It's a little rough, but it's also still very fun, but it's rough.
Oh, my God. Okay. So... gross, first of all. Very gross. I'm going to be coming in hot on this one.
Hot and heavy.
So I should provide the disclaimer that I forget to do sometimes when I'm very negative about the wines, which is I do not discourage anyone from ordering these wines just because I don't like them, because taste is subjective, et cetera, et cetera. And also, you know, the winemaker is doing their thing and Jamie's an expert and I trust him that they're doing it well, even if I find it completely unappealing.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
All right, so it smells like, you know, like there's like a slightly acrid smell to molasses. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying.
So it's molasses minus all the good smells. It's just the part that kind of burns. It smells like, I've been trying to refine this since we were talking off mic about it. It smells like cat pee, but not fresh cat pee. I don't know, like you went away for a weekend and you put out enough food for the cat and you put out like an extra litter box, but that you knew when you were going to come back that the cat pee was going to calcify or whatever. And it was just going to get real bad. Or if you're like me and you ever had a cat who, you know, oh, I looked at the litter box once, I can't use it now, and he'll just fucking pee somewhere. And you discover a few days later, like, what is this smell downstairs in the fucking carpeted room? Oh, the cat must have done this. Well, it smells like old, stankified, dried cat pee.
Gross.
And the bad parts of molasses.
Super gross, Scott.
Oh, yeah, as you said off mic, apple cider vinegar.
Yep.
I don't have much experience drinking apple cider vinegar, smelling it for sure, but the taste for me is, which I guess is vinegar, is when I find the like quart bottle of apple cider in the back of the fridge and like, oh, I've still got apple cider. And no, I do not.
You've got vinegar now.
Yep. And the bottle is like swollen from all the gas being released. Yep. This tastes like that. We would say body is light, right? This is very light body. Oh yeah,
for sure.
High acid, very high acid.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Big time.
No tannin. I can't tell on the alcohol. What is the deal with the alcohol?
Low alcohol.
Ooh, there's like a, is it sweet tarts? It's sweet tarts. There's like a sweet tart thing, but not the sugar, just the sour.
Just the sour parts.
Just the intense sour of the like coating of the sweet tart.
Or like the sour citric acid sugar that they coat Sour Patch Kids with.
Yeah. These are all candies that I hate, by the way.
You don't like sour candies?
I don't like any sour candy. We've discussed this on the show before.
You only think that chocolate is appropriate as a candy, right?
Well, it's just the only one that's good.
You're just wrong.
Anything else is either sour or attempting to emulate fruit, which it does badly.
You don't like gummies?
Not really.
Gummy bears?
I mean,
do you hate joy, Scott?
I don't hate joy. I just don't like sour candy or gummies.
You don't like Necco wafers? No, I don't like. Nobody likes Necco wafers.
No one likes Necco wafers.
Garbage.
They're just fun when they're on the string.
Yeah, the necklace ones.
The necklace one. That's the only way that they're fun. And then you throw them out and don't eat them.
I usually ate them, but that's why I was really fat growing up.
God. You ate the string too?
I hate the string too.
There's like a burnt thing going on too.
I kind of think that's tied in with the molasses thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, like something like caramelized burnt. Like if I tried to
you're
deglaze a pan with wine and then let it go too hard and didn't scrape the pan enough and it just got like brown and gross.
Or like almost like an electric kind of burnt.
A little bit of an electrical burn.
Yeah. Like started burning its plastic off.
Yeah. That's very good, Jamie. All right, so what do you get in this that isn't what I've accurately described? What are the parts that I like? Do you like any of the notes that I've described so far?
I like the whole thing. And like, disclaimer, because this one deserves a disclaimer and a big one. This producer, and we'll get into like the specifics about this producer, but this producer is a leader in the natural wine movement. They are an example of a producer that goes way too far in the funky natty direction. Sometimes they end up with a product that is really compelling and fruit forward and quite delicious. Other times they end up with a product like this. I get the warm fuzzies when I think about Partida Creus.
Is this like a sense memory thing?
Yeah, it is. Because I was purchasing these wines in 2012 and 2013 for restaurants I was running. And that was a time in my life that I was like having a great time. You know, I was a newly minted general manager and I was running my own beverage program and every, and like the natural wine movement had really started to gain traction in Philadelphia. And I felt resonant with it at that time because of the focus on regenerative agriculture and all of that. And I also felt excited by the wines because they tasted different than a lot of the classically presenting wines that I had learned on. That's a bad face you're making. It's a really, like, your face normally isn't that attractive. Now it's much, much worse.
My eyes are actually watering from the taste of this wine. Like, they are actually tearing up. It is so acidic and sour.
So, disclaimer, this wine is for the natty boys. This wine is for people who are into natural wine or are into sour beer. This wine tastes like a barrel-aged sour without the carbonation. Like, if we force-carbed this wine and, like, served it to somebody blind, served it to me blind, I'd be like, this is a beer. So this is for a particular palate.
Not mine.
Not yours. I really resonate with it. I don't...
Well, hang on. Do you resonate with it because you have fond memories of that time in your life when you were ordering, or do you actually like it?
So I resonate with it as a wine and as a producer because I have fond memories of it. I resonate with it as the juice in the glass that I like to drink because it tastes like sour beer and I like that. The barrier to me, let's say, purchasing this wine for sale in a restaurant is that it doesn't represent itself as a wine particularly well. And this is one of the problems with Partida Creus specifically is you don't know what the fuck you're going to get vintage to vintage. Like, I had never tasted the 2020 before right this very moment. Like, I purchased some of it for the restaurant, not this wine, but a different wine. And I was terrified. I was like, am I just going to have to, like, pour this off at a ridiculously low cost? But I took the risk, and I popped a couple of bottles, and they were singing. They were gorgeous. They were, like, mineral-driven and beautiful. And I was really, really pleased, and that gave me hope for this.
Yeah, this is not... singing.
No.
This is not.
No, this is like is like a guttural groan.
I would say it's singing only in the sense of like the opera singer who shatters glasses. Like it is a piercing frequency.
Yes. Yeah, it is. I really like it. I also do like sour candy. So if you're out there and you like sour candies, your lemon heads or your sweet tarts or your Sour Patch Kids, like you might like this wine. It tastes very much, if we're talking about fruit character, like lemon. I was hoping for more because this is an area of the world where you can get pretty good ripeness. Clearly, they haven't gotten it here.
All right. Pour me another fucking glass of this swill. In our notes, you have exclamation point after the SP. Is that just your enthusiasm or is there really an SP on there? Or is there really an exclamation point?
There's not an exclamation point. No, the SP, the exclamation point is to indicate to me that I like that the name of the grape is Subirat Parent. And I don't really know if I'm pronouncing that right. I probably am not. But they refer to this wine as subpar.
I agree. I don't know what par for this producer is.
There is no par for this producer. That's the thing that I'm like trying to express here. Right. Is like this producer is all over the fucking map, and I don't hate on anybody for not liking them. Like they became part of the natural wine hype machine, and people like put them up on a pedestal, and that's when I started to disengage because I don't think it's appropriate to have them on a pedestal when they're this inconsistent.
Jamie, I find it compelling. I'm on my second glass. I don't like it, but it is extremely interesting.
I really like it. I think I And I also, being a person in wine, we are notorious for loving things with high acidity. And this is like off the charts acid.
Well, I think we've talked about this on the show. I don't know if it is a digression that's made it into episode cuts before, but the how you wine people get into the high acidity or the natty stuff or the shit that's weird, to me feels analogous to how film people generally, oftentimes, especially like film programmers or those types of people that I've worked with, generally people who are deep into movies are way more into horror movies than general audiences are because of the provocations of it, right? Like horror movies and genre movies will take you to extreme places that even if you love intimate personal dramas, like they're never going to hit that like raw nerve, right?
Right.
And it's the provocation and that intense emotional or visceral reaction that you can really respond to and you can't really get anywhere else.
I think that that is a really good analogy. So for the listener out there, if you have any inclination toward either the funky, weird, natural wines or sour beers, you might like this wine. In fact, you probably will.
I mean, I don't even like sour beer, but I like sour beer more than I like this wine. And just thinking about it in the context of sour beer, I feel like I'm already giving it more of a chance.
That then becomes another barrier, right? Because this is $32 for a bottle.
Yeah, that's too much.
For what this is, a 9.5% alcohol drink that I would put away a bottle of this very, very quickly. If I were having friends over, like wine friends, this would be the first bottle that we'd start with, and it would be gone in 10 minutes.
Oh, why does it have to smell so bad? I can forgive and even understand a lot of the things in it that I'm not liking, but the smell? The smell, Jamie.
It's the smell.
It's the smell.
I feel saturated by it.
Saturated by it.
And we're back on the Matrix.
We never left.
Why does it have to smell like that?
Because
it's like the flaws that I'm referencing when I talk about flawed wines, Scott, this one is showing basically all of them except for Brettanomyces.
So this is not a BM wine.
This is not a BM wine. This is an EA wine. Ethyl acetate is big time on this wine. Like, it smells like nail polish remover. And talk about volatile acidity. Like I said, I think this smells straight up like, what's the brand of apple cider vinegar that comes, it says it comes with the mother and it's all like cloudy. Bragg's is the name.
It's provocative. It's provocative, and I'm calling it right now.
It's provocative. It gets the people going.
It pairs well with Pig in the City.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The darkness,
not
the
as much
bleakness,
Happy Feet too.
The strangeness of Babe Pig in the City.
I love the tragedy of
Babe Pig in the City. This wine goes well with it.
This wine with in particular the scene in the ballroom when Mrs.
Hoggett
is jumping on the bungee cord.
Yeah, she's
from
in
clown
pants, like gigantic clown pants.
Oh my god! Yes,
with the hula hoop.
Because she stole the clown pants from the dead clown who started all of the nonsense to begin with by stealing her luggage.
Yep. Well, he didn't steal the luggage.
The chimp stole the luggage.
The chimp stole the luggage. The dead clown. Mickey Rooney.
But then he pointed her around the corner and stole Babe.
Yeah, that is true. For me, we should just get into it.
This is a good transition.
This pairs with the darkest scene in the movie, which is the pit bull chase, which is so dark and so upsetting, and then has the like peak of beauty of the entire movie, where this fucking terrifying pit bull that is chasing Babe all over the insane backlot set of where the illegal contraband animal hotel is, that's like on the canals of Florence, but it's every city in the world.
Venice.
Thank you. I'm not even going to retake that. We're not even going to do studio magic. I'm not a worldly person. You're right. It's Venice. Venice is the one with the canals. He's chasing Babe and he's about to kill him, and it's genuinely frightening. And then Babe turns to face him and says, "Why?" Like in the face of terror and unmitigated hostility for no reason, he just turns with his beautiful little heart and says, "Why?" And this wine is that moment. And also then that the dog goes over the bridge and is choking and drowning at the same time. And Babe, with his beautiful sweetheart, goes and rescues him, which makes me fucking cry every time I watch the movie. It's so wonderful.
The fact that the audience is subjected to watching a dog drown.
Yeah. Nearly drown.
Nearly drown.
Nearly drown. He's in the act of drowning, but he doesn't drown.
That's correct.
He's drowning.
That is a cruel thing to subject an audience to.
And an audience of children.
And too. Especially an audience of children. Holy fuck. I mean, it was 1998, so we were in our teenage years.
We were in the 12 to 13 zone, yeah.
Right. And I think when I saw that movie, it affected me viscerally. And then I watched it again for this episode and had completely forgotten that that was a thing that happened until like the lead up. And you see him like get his leg caught up in the chain and you're like, oh no, oh no, oh no. Then he's in the fucking water and you're like, I know that he's going to be saved, but this is no less unpleasant.
For the dog violence sensitive out there among you, and I know many of you are, including yep. dear friend of the show, Johnny Words. By the way, Johnny Words, the bit in the beginning of Ted Lasso season 2 where the dog gets hit by the soccer ball and dies, still funny. I'm sorry, it's funny. It's funny. I don't like violence against dogs in the real world, but when people push that particular button that audiences can't fucking deal with, where they'll watch a movie where like 100 people get murdered in brutal violence and it's perfectly fine, but then something bad happens to a dog and they all go, oh, I fucking hate audiences sometimes. Anyway, the dog survives. The dog becomes Babe's friend.
Biggest supporter, in fact.
Right. The muscle man for Babe in his new communist manifesto, his new
dictatorship.
Anyway, let's talk about it.
Yes, let's talk about it.
Babe, Pig in the City. This is a 1998 film co-written, produced, and directed by one George Miller, who is, as previously mentioned, the genius behind the Mad Max films. Miller co-wrote and produced The First Babe, which is a serene and bucolic 1995 hit that is directed by Chris Noonan about a talking pig who becomes, everybody knows the fucking premise of Babe, he's a talking pig, he becomes the prize sheep herder.
Far M.U.
That'll do, pig. James Cromwell. Lovely movie. That film, Babe, 1995's Babe, was a huge global hit, making over $250 million worldwide. And it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It won the Oscar for Best Visual Effects. Babe 2, Miller decided that he wanted to direct it himself. There are many stories and conflicting points of view as to how much of a hands-on and possibly very aggressive and possibly credit-stealing producer Miller was on the first film. I do not want to get into that because it doesn't actually bear that much weight on this movie. But Babe 2, Babe, Pig in the City, is a strange, dark fable wherein Babe, voiced this time by Elizabeth Daly, having accidentally caused a critical injury to his beloved Farmer Hoggett, a very brief appearance by James Cromwell.
Which also is a stressful scene to watch.
Very fucking dark. Yeah, it's basically...
Because he would be dead if those events played out.
Yeah, it's basically like the opening of There Will Be Blood, where he's down the well and then the thing falls, except it's Babe's fault that he like gets hit in the head with the fucking...
With a pump.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. But so Babe, having caused this injury to the farmer, must travel to the city, the unnamed city, the city that is every city everywhere with
capital
all the major
T,
landmarks.
Capital C, city.
The city.
The city.
Must travel to the city with Mrs. Hoggett, played by Magda Subinski, to win a contest in the hopes of saving the farm from foreclosure from the fucking suits from the bank. Upon arriving in the city, Babe and Mrs. Hoggett are immediately separated. Babe joins up with a troop of wayward animals who are taking secret refuge in an illegal animal hotel.
Because apparently in the city, it's illegal to have animals.
It's illegal to have animals in residences, or it's illegal to have animals in... At the very least, her animal hotel is illegal.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mrs. Hoggett can find no hotels that will accept even a wee pig.
That's right. A wee pig. So while Mrs. Hoggett is searching high and low all over the city for her beloved pig, Babe is with this weirdo troop of animals and hijinks ensue, let's say. The sequel was largely disliked upon release. The reviews were basically toxic. It made just shy of $70 million worldwide against a $90 million budget. And critics derided the major departure in tone from the original. There were a few exceptions. Gene Siskel, not always my favorite critic, but he named it the best film of 1998. Thank you, Gene Siskel.
Damn right.
It, of course, rules. As of this recording, Babe, Pig in the City is available to stream on Stars, if you have that. and is also available wherever you get your VODs. I have the Blu-ray, and it sits very proudly on my child's shelf, because I guess I'm a bad parent, because I think it's okay to show him a movie where, you know, animals struggle and dogs nearly drown and, like, violence occurs and we have to deal with our failures and our mistakes. It's a heavy fucking movie.
So much going on in this movie. There's between the so family much of going on. Primates.
Yeah.
Like, which is, you deal with, like, food and housing insecurity with them. You deal with the idea of losing parental figures or becoming parental figures. You deal with, like, just them alone. There's so much meat to dig into, let alone your protagonist, who is a pig.
We still have Ferdinand the duck returning from the first movie in a series of largely disconnected, like, tiny vignettes, just tracking his bizarre journey to even make it to the city.
I do love that he lies to a pelican about his ability to fly in order to hitch a ride. That might be my favorite part.
There's so many great little, even just like one scene characters, like the drug sniffing dog at the airport.
Oh my God, the narc dog.
The narc dog who gets Babe in trouble.
Who really is the reason why all of the misadventures start. They miss their connecting flight because of this fucking narc dog trying to show off.
Yeah, and the pre-TSA,
all cops
TSA,
are bastards.
Yeah. Drags poor farmer or poor Mrs. Hoggett in and does like a strip search on her and humiliates the poor woman.
They do the fucking glove snap.
Yep.
Not nice.
No.
Not nice at all.
Not nice at all. Jamie, so we're on the record as both being in favor of this movie. What are your strong feelings about it?
So I saw this probably in theaters, I would imagine. I don't have a clear memory of it, but I definitely saw it at some point around the time that it was released, either in theaters or on VHS. I liked it then. I certainly, at the age of 13, wasn't prepared to grapple with all of the things that this movie has to throw at you. I was and continue to be viscerally affected by the dog almost drowning.
Also, the whole chase. Like, the chase is genuinely frightening.
It is.
And Babe is terrified, and it's like Miller just can't help but make it a spectacular and thrilling action set piece.
Right.
You know, it's a set piece on par with any of the great, like, action scenes in the Mad Max movies,
correct,
for example. The way he just, like, builds and escalates, and then the dog has the chain around him, and then the chain is dragging the push lawnmower, and then it's ripping apart fences, and it gets caught, and it's just thing after thing after thing after thing, and it builds to, like, a terrifying crescendo.
One of the things that I was struck by this time is basically every character, with the exception of Babe and Mrs. Hoggett, and I guess Farmer Hoggett,
who is barely in the movie.
Who's barely in the movie.
Yeah. James Cromwell got paid, though, I'm sure.
Everyone, until they learn their lesson, some of them don't, is acting in some way just in naked self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the central thing about this movie, is that people will act in their own self-interest kind of no matter what.
Yeah. Until
altruism
somebody shows them
basically
another
doesn't
way.
Exist. Yeah. Until you're taught about it. Babe is the one who just cares about everybody to his own detriment the whole fucking time. And thank God he gets a happily ever after, but it's by the skin of his fucking teeth.
Well, and through the great hard efforts of Mrs. Hoggett, who is just like genuinely heroic the entire time.
She can't imagine going back to her husband, who she loves deeply, without his pig that he loves deeply.
Yeah. And it's not even about the money at that point, because, like, they've missed their connecting flight. They're not going to go do the thing with the contest where the pig is going to win the money to try and save the farm. He loves the damn pig.
As far as she's concerned, the farm is foreclosed on, but she knows that in some way, like, if they have to move to the city and live in a hovel together, they will live there with this pig.
Yeah.
I really was kind of taken by the primate family. They're just so good. The way they present from beginning to end, those four characters change so much over the course of the film.
Thelonious is the orangutan, mm-hmm. the gentleman orangutan who always wears a fancy suit jacket. Thelonious, voiced by James Cosmo, and then Stephen Wright and Glenn Headley voice Bob and Zooty, respectively. Glenn Headley, she's like one of those, like, I've seen her a million times on TV and in supporting parts in movies, and she has such a distinctive voice, and you, like, recognize it right away. Amazing voice casting.
Right. And they call Mickey Rooney himself.
Himself, yeah. Mickey Rooney, who is, like, the aging alcoholic, like children's magician performer that this group of primates lives with, and they refer to him exclusively as himself, even after his unfortunate demise.
But then Mrs. Hoggett gains their trust and their love.
She becomes herself. Yeah.
Thelonious is hanging laundry with her at the end.
It's really lovely.
It's beautiful.
The animal performances are all amazing in this movie, too. Like, the animal performances are good in the first movie. And, you know, the Babe famously is a mixture of animals with CGI mouth movement for the Mr. Ed effect. And there are some animatronic creatures for some of the more elaborate stunts or performance work.
Right.
The second one leans way harder on actual, like, trained animal performances with CGI modification for the mouths. But I find them all so compelling. Maybe because so many of them are primates who are just, like, easier for us to relate to the way that they emote, but they really stick in my memory. When the baby's being born, when Zooty, like, she delivers, like, this tiny, that one is, like, actually, like, an animatronic chimp, but it's so affecting. Such a powerful little scene.
It really is.
Yeah, and the way that it, like, brings that whole family together, and the way that their behavior is transformed by, like, the presence of this small life.
And it takes them out of alignment. Like, fully, like, they've been on this path with Thelonious where they follow him all the time. And then she's pregnant. And then that now they fall out of alignment with Thelonious. They could have been thick black outline cartoon characters that are just like, these are the bad guys. But no, absolutely not. We have to have nuance here.
Yeah, they have an antagonistic role, and then they turn, and the movie is just like, it's never, and the first one is this way too, where it never takes the easy choice. It always, like, seeks out complexity and depth and humanity, like, even in all the animal characters.
The world is cruel, and largely people will act in their own self-interest. But when you don't, when you find a way to think about other people, then things get better, is kind of a takeaway there.
It's quite bleak, I will say, and I'm not, you know, parents at home, like, you know, I'm not responsible for whether or not you think these movies are appropriate for your kids. Like, my child is 5. I think I first showed him this movie when he was 4. And I think when probably a lot of the darkness kind of sailed over his head, but some of the more intense scenes, like, he very much responded to, but never said he wanted to stop watching it. But it is a very bleak worldview in the sequel that the first one doesn't really have. Like, the first one, what darkness is in it just comes from, like, the reality of farm life.
Right.
But it doesn't have the bleakness of contemporary urban living. And how you're saying, like, it's self-interest, and everybody is out for their own, and there's hostility, and there's violence, and there's suspicion
even
around
every
corner.
Even the good guys are out for, like, even Ferdinand is out for himself. He wants to find Babe because Babe is his ticket to not get eaten. Not for any reason other than, like, I want to stay alive.
Yeah.
Not because he likes Babe, not because he's loyal, but because he wants to stay alive.
The first movie is very episodic. You know, the it's a series of, I think, 6 or more chapters.
And they do that in this movie.
And they do it in this one as well. And yet it feels like a little bit more, not linear of a narrative, but it's more of a straight line. Like, it has more of a narrative than the first one does. The first one is a series of, like, of idealistic, like, farm life, you know, storybook chapters. And this one, it continues the, like, chapter framing device with the little mice always there to, like, sing on screen as they're getting irised in and irised out. For as much as I'm saying it's not episodic, there are these wonderful little vignettes that just kind of, like, pop in and out and vanish, and characters who just show up for a brief moment and then disappear. One of the images that leaves, like, it always comes to mind when I think of this movie is the mice who have sort of, like, stowed away in Mrs. Hoggett's luggage. Yep. Who come along with them when they're in the hotel, and they sneak into this one room
with the cats.
And it is a choir of cats who are almost, like, in this, like, cascading series of steps. It looks like a like a massive, like, cathedral organ.
It's like a chamber orchestra of cats.
So funny and so frightening for those little mice.
Yep.
Genuinely great. God, another one is Fleelik, who is the dog who's in, like a doggy, like, back legs wheelchair.
Yep.
Who is voiced by Adam Goldberg, of all people. And I always think of the image of, since we started talking about the movie today, I think of the image of Fleelik being dragged along behind a car with his little wheels, like trying to keep up as he, because this is the animal control, like the pounds van that is taking all the animals away that they have to go and rescue them. Stressful and weird and intense imagery, and like seeing a dog whose back legs are all jacked up and he's got to be in wheels is something that we don't typically see in movies. Like movies, they stray away from putting dogs into stress, especially children's films.
He's also blind and he asks other animals if they're cats because cats are not welcome where he is, but he can't tell whether or not you're a cat.
Yeah, it's just, it's jam-packed full of like big ideas and great characters and fascinating scenes. Like I love, so after Babe has, through his generosity, has basically changed the behavior of the pit bull, the terrifying fucking pit bull, and gets to put on the pit bull's like spiked collar, which becomes like Babe's look for the rest of the movie.
Which is so good.
Super fucking punk rock for like a sweet, lovable baby piglet. But then they come back into the hotel and the hotel proprietress has been taken away for keeping contraband animals there. And the animals have nothing to fucking eat. So they, Babe decides, and the dog says, "Listen to the pig. We'll do what the pig says." And Babe in a benevolent communist lord sort of way says, "Well, we're going to divide up this huge jar of jelly beans and everybody will come forward and get one." And some of the animals and some of the apes are like, "Well, we're bigger. We want more. I'm hungrier." And it's like, "Nope, everybody gets one. We're going to do the best thing for everyone. We're part of a community. We have to work together or we'll all starve." And like Babe genuinely forges a community of these animals in the hotel that did not exist prior to him being there.
Well, I mean, the community is partly forged by force, by his doggy protector. Well,
by threat of violence, yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
And like he is thrust into leadership role largely against his own will.
And then they free the animals from the pound and go to the gala ball at the fancy rich people reception. God. Where Mrs. Hoggett shows up.
It's insane.
And then it has the bonkers set piece where there's a chef who's chasing after Babe and the animals are all there and there's chaos at this like fancy like white tie rich people's event and she's bouncing all over the place trying to save Babe and then there's like waiters and chefs that are swinging on the curtain.
It's insane.
It is such a delightful and weird set piece and like my kid just goes apeshit whenever we watch it.
Right.
It's just so much fun to watch. Even for the darkness, like there's darkness and there's sadness and it doesn't flinch away from that. But then there's beauty and there's just like zany fun.
It's disappointing, but not surprising that this was not financially successful in the box office.
No. And you can see why people would have reacted negatively to that. Like I read a sampling of critical reviews yesterday in prep for this. And it's like, people are like, yeah, it took the innocence and the sweetness and the simplicity of their first one and replaced it with dour cynicism and brutality and like, yeah, cool.
Yep.
Like heaven forbid a sequel not just give us the same thing that we got before.
But it kept the sweetness of like the essential sweetness of the character of Babe.
Well, right. And Babe applied is it. The same and puts him in a new world.
Correct.
It takes him out of the farm and puts him in, you know, modern living. Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, we'll talk about it with the next movie, but it's like, it's the classic George Miller thing with sequels. Like George Miller has made a lot of sequels in his career between the three Mad Max sequels and Babe 2 and Happy Feet 2. And he was just never content to repeat himself. You know, he would probably just get bored. Like he wants to do different things, you know?
Right.
And as an audience, like we should embrace that. Yeah. I don't want the same shit every time. It's nice when your sequels surprise you.
I think it's an expectations game too. Like not just to, we're trained so much to expect sequels to be a continuation of a thing.
Right. Well, that's why sequels, because it made money and we're going to give the audience more and hopefully the audience will return, but then the audience wants more of the same.
Right. So do you think this movie would have been more successful if it was a whole other franchise, just like a similar-ish movie?
I mean, I don't. This movie's too weird for mainstream audiences.
Really fucking like, weird.
It's way too weird for to be a children's film, but it's also delightful. I'm a big fan. I don't know. It's hard to predict what would have been successful. Would it have been more successful if it was just like more of Babe's adventures on the farm, or if it was the same plot of this one, but just you know, sweet and not cynical and not. It's not cynical. Like it's very much not cynical because Babe is able to affect change and make everybody's lives better. And he makes the world around him better.
Right. Just by being good.
But it's fucking dark. Would people have responded to it more if it wasn't so fucking dark? Probably. But like, then we wouldn't have Babe Pig in the City.
Right.
Which is an unsung masterpiece.
And it's wonderful. And you should watch it with or without children.
Yeah.
Like, this is one of those movies that, like, it resonates with me as a 37-year-old man. It resonated with me as a 13-year-old boy. Like, I think it's fucking great.
Yeah, I mean, I never saw it as a child. I think I saw the first Babe, you know, as a kid when it came out, but I never saw the second one until sometime in like my late 20s.
Really?
Yeah, and I love it. And it's like, nothing has ever looked like this movie either. Like, I've never seen a movie that looks like this thing. It looks kind of like a Tim Burton movie minus all the goth.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's that like hyper stylized, yep, like extremely designed, like hermetically sealed fantasy world.
Right. We're going to, the aesthetic of the city is like, it's all cities and no cities at the same time.
Yeah. And, but it's like, it's all the personalities of every city cranked up to 11, even though it does not look like the real world in any conceivable way.
Right. This was a movie that I remember my mother responded to. I'm sure that you can imagine.
Perfect sense, yeah, that Sharon would have loved this
fucking
movie.
Fucking loved it.
Yeah.
And particularly the scene where Mrs. Hoggett is swinging from the rafters. Like,
it's so loony. It's, yeah, so like, it's like a cartoon set piece where it's a classic George Miller thing where, like, yeah, physics don't need to exist in a real way because it's a movie. So let's break all the rules and figure out the craziest way to do it.
Right.
That whole sequence feels very much akin to the climactic, like, Polecats, you know, crescendo of the final chase in Fury Road.
Which we've already discussed, yeah, and which fucking rules.
Yeah, but it's of a piece with that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are people swinging from one side to another, so there is that.
Yeah, but the
movement of it and the threat from all sides aspect, yeah, of it.
Like, and the beauty of it, too. Like, he's so good about dance is a good way to put it. Miller is always great about getting beauty in movement, like not just the kinetics of it, but just the aesthetic joy of seeing movement across a frame, whether it's a body or an animal or, right, a vehicle or the cameras, like movement through a space. He always gets beauty out of it. And I just find that sequence so transcendently good. Like, it knocks my socks off in the way that it pays off the plot and the character arcs and the emotion and crescendos the intensity and the comedy of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty outstanding.
It really is.
Yep. Babe 2.
Babe 2.
Big fan.
Pig in the City. Watch it. If you haven't already, like, please watch it.
Watch it with your children. The smaller, the better. And then there's this movie. Jamie, see if this sounds familiar to you, okay?
Okay.
Happy Feet 2.
Yep.
This is a 2011 computer animated movie co-written, produced, and directed by George Miller. It is a sequel to the 2006 original. That film, the first Happy Feet, is a jukebox musical about singing, dancing penguins that takes a sharp left turn towards explicit environmentalism in its last act. It was a huge global hit. It was the 7th highest grossing movie of 2006, higher grossing than Casino Royale.
Wow.
And it won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. The sequel that we're here to talk about, Happy Feet 2, spelled out T-W-O, not content to be Happy Feet numeral 2, is a weirder and much more ambitious movie than the first, following our hero from the first film, Mumble, voiced by Elijah Wood, as he tries to rescue the penguins of his home community of Emperor Land, who are trapped in their valley without food by a rogue iceberg dislodged by climate change.
It's real, y'all.
It's super real. These penguins have to deal with it. All the while, Mumble is struggling to repair damage to his relationship with his rebellious little baby son, Eric, voiced by Ava Akers. The cast of characters is enormous and ridiculous, including, among others, Pink as Mumble's partner, Gloria, Robin Williams in an unfortunate dual role as Ramon and Loveless.
Unfortunate because of Ramon's accent?
Because of the classically Robin Williams-y, very stereotypical ethnic accents, yeah, for not, both Ramon and Loveless.
It's, yeah, not good.
Hasn't aged well. I think they're great performances. And obviously, like, I love Robin Williams, but Loveless, this would not fly today.
Loveless is better.
Loveless is not as egregious as Ramon.
And I think is also a better performance.
And a better character, too. Ramon's, right, pretty one-note. But so it also has Hank Azaria as the flying penguin guru Sven. Sven. Love Sven.
He's not a flying penguin, Scott. He's a...
Spoilers, Jamie.
He's,
spoilers.
He's a poofin.
He's a poofin. He's a fraud. He's a poofin with a fake beak. Also has Sofia Vergara, Anthony LaPaglia, Hugo Weaving, Common, and my very favorite part of the entire movie, features the voice performances of Brad Pitt and Matt Damon as Will and Bill, two krill who witness their swarm getting devoured by a whale and have an existential crisis and go on a movie-long quest to ascend the food chain and eat something with a face.
It's worth noting at this point that the existential crisis had begun prior to the whale.
You just can't help but contradict them. You just can't help yourself.
They were already on a quest.
You are the Bill to my Will, all right? I'm going on a journey, and all you can do is think about yourself, all right, Jamie? Also, my vocal performance is better than yours.
Wow, rude.
You're the Matt Damon to my... I think
You think Pitt...
Pitt is amazing, and I think Matt Damon is fine as a vocal performer.
I've responded much more to the Damon performance.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're fucking Bill the Krill. Damn right. Although he does get the worst / best line in the movie when he says, "I've lost my will." such a good thing. Shockingly, the movie was largely disliked upon release, earning mostly negative reviews, wildly underperforming at the box office, and causing Miller's new animation studio, Dr. D, that was founded just to make Happy Feet 2, to close its doors forever.
Jesus Christ.
After its first and only feature. It, of course, rules, and as of this recording, it is available to stream on the HBO Max or wherever you get your VODs. Jamie, you had never seen either Happy Feet before.
That is correct.
So, briefly, what were your thoughts on the first film? And then tell me about your thoughts of Happy Feet 2. I'm going to get some more wine while you're talking.
The first one's fine. It's good. I enjoyed it. I had, like, some issues with it, largely due to its incredible unevenness and the abruptness of, like, the ending and its left turn into environmentalism.
Well, and the live action, too, where he ends up, like, in an actual live action zoo with real people watching him is very... It's hard to look at.
It is. It's very hard to look at.
And the animation is really rough, too.
The people in Happy Feet 2 were a little rough to look at, too.
Yeah.
But, like... whatever, it was established as part of the world. I didn't have as much issue with that aesthetic as I did with just some of the narrative choices in the first one.
Yeah. It loses a lot of steam in the last act, especially once he's like separated from the community.
I think the moment he pushes Gloria away, like she's ready to go with him and you're like, yeah, we've taken this journey. Like I was ready to accept the two of them together, like as an audience, I think that it walks you to that point and then Mumble like kicks her out and it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like the right thing for the character or for the movie. But I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I had a good time.
I really like Hugh Jackman as Mumble's dad, who it's been a while since
I've watched that one.
But he's just Elvis. Hugh Jackman doing Elvis. And yeah, in the first one, something that is completely discarded by the second movie is that all the Emperor Penguins have a heart song. And it's the song that speaks to their soul. And Mumble cannot fucking sing at all, but he can dance and that makes him an outcast. And by the end of the movie, he teaches everybody that however you express yourself,
that's your heart song.
That's your heart song. That's your art. That's Speed Racer making art by doing crazy fucking flips in his car. Tani and my son were watching that the other day, and I was downstairs like cleaning up and doing laundry, and then I heard that the Grand Prix started, and I was like, well, I have to go watch the Grand Prix.
Of course you do.
Not watching the previous 2 hours of the movie. Started watching the Grand Prix, and the moment he gets the car to start up again and tears off,
oh my God.
The final lap, I just started crying.
You have to.
Every single time. That fucking makes me cry. Anyway, I digress. The first movie, but yeah, and then the second movie starts, and everyone is a singing and dancing penguin.
Correct.
And now dancing is the thing.
Well, Elijah Wood still cannot sing.
Right.
He can't sing, but he's taught everyone to dance.
Right. You know, all the choreography, at least in the first movie, is by Savion Glover.
Who is that?
He's a world famous tap dancing person. Did all of the penguin choreography.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that. And also like the tap dancing is great and I love it. And it's super duper fun.
So stupid having penguins tap dance, which is part of the joy. I like that it's silly.
I love it. I love that. But in contrast, the second movie, Happy Feet 2, Scott, is one in a krillion.
It is one in a krillion. Yeah.
It fucking rules.
I think it's equally uneven to the first movie.
Yeah,
but the unevenness is in the beginning. The beginning to kind of get all the pieces in place is really clunky. And
then it feels so, as I described, Teen Titans Go as kind of an ADHD fever dream.
Yeah.
Like the first 20 minutes of this movie is like, okay, where am I? Who am I following?
Yeah. It's very hyperactive. There's a lot of pieces to set up.
I think it does a bad job of setting up your point of view to begin with. But once it gets past that, the pace, I think, is really great. It's kinetic and it moves very, very quickly, but it's awesome. And the dual narratives of Will and Bill up against the surface dwellers. You can't even just say penguins because there are puffins and there are...
Elephant seals. Brian, the elephant seal.
Oh my God.
The elephant seal who never goes back. He can never go backwards.
Sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards.
To go forwards, Brian. it's so good. And it is very much like... emotionally and thematically and structurally, like, of a piece with Babe 2. It's this other idea about, like, all these other communities are self-interested, and through Mumble and through Eric, that they are able to convince other communities to come together and help each other out.
The Adeles come to help.
The Adeles from Adeliland, yep.
And then the elephant seals. Because selflessly, Mumble couldn't leave Brian behind.
Right.
And risked his life by antagonizing a leopard seal.
Yep.
Which...
genuinely frightening sequence.
Extremely frightening sequence.
Moms and dads out there, the movie has a PG rating for mild, rude humor, which I think is just in reference to, like, there's one scene where a baby penguin pees, and then there's another joke about, like, bird poop. But, like, otherwise, the humor is fairly benign. But there is one frightening sequence that the MPAA described as peril. where and I'm sure this would have been incredible and terrifying to see in 3D the way the movie was originally released, but where Mumble is being chased by a leopard seal, and it is quite frightening. Yeah. Great sequence.
Really great sequence. I don't know why I was reminded, apropos of nothing, the sequence where Loveless goes to get the attention of the humans, and the humans start playing Led Zeppelin back at him.
No,
they play...
It's We Are the Champions.
We're the champions.
Yeah, Loveless, like a big fat penguin in like a Rastafarian sweater. It's just like a rainbow sweater.
He's wearing a rainbow sweater, but then it gets unraveled and he ends up wearing a Rastafarian hat.
Right. But then he swims out to catch the attention of the humans to think that like the human ship will come and maybe rescue all the trapped emperors. And he plays air guitar, the guitar solo from We Are the Champions. And then the humans see him with their binoculars.
And they grab their guitar and their amp and they play back at him.
And then so they have like a dueling guitar solo, one of which is an air guitar played by a penguin. It is so demented and so funny too. To say nothing of like the movie's like vegetarian message, you know? That like Sven the Poofin, when he in his flashbacks and he spends time being rehabilitated by humans on one of their Antarctic exploration vessels, and he sees like a bunch of fucking like chickens on a rotisserie and thinks that all the humans are going to eat the penguins, like, and he, you know, fucking flies away like that. That's a provocative image for a child to see.
It really is. And then the counterpoint of Will and Bill. Bill in particular wanting to become a predator.
Will wants to become whatever.
I cannot keep them straight.
Will wants to be, what? Because they all look alike, Jamie.
They do. They say it in the beginning.
They do literally all look alike because they're krill. Yeah, but yeah, and he wants to become a predator because he doesn't want to just be at the bottom ass end of the food chain. He thinks he's going to eat a leopard seal. It's so good. He has like a complete existential freakout that for most of the movie you think has nothing to do with the A plot. Of the emperors.
Right.
And until it comes together in like, it's another thing that like George Miller does with these movies. There is transcendence.
Right.
Where the connection between Mumble, I guess, spoilers, if that's something you're conscious about with a children's film about dancing CGI penguins, like whatever. But Mumble has brought together not just the Adeles and the leopard seals to dance to rhythmically break up the iceberg so that the emperors will be liberated, but that just the music and the rhythm inspires Bill and Will on the underside of the iceberg
to then inspire their whole community,
their entire community to start dancing, tap dancing along with the same rhythm. And only through all of them creating art together are they able to like break down the barrier and solve the threats of climate change. But yeah, and it's all too under pressure.
Yep.
Which just gets me, like, I fucking love that song, obviously. And you have all of these animals dancing. The lyrics are
quite poignant.
And the rhythms and the lyrics are poignant. And you have fucking like Pink taking lead vocals. And that woman has some pipes on her.
She sure does.
Like I'm getting chills just thinking about it. The ending of the whole, it's just like viscerally and aesthetically, like very thrilling to listen to. But then emotionally, like what it builds to and how it's also the culmination of this like troubled father-son relationship throughout the movie. Like it gets me, man. It gets me so good.
Oh God. Speaking of the culmination of the troubled father-son relationship, when Eric finds out that he's an opera singer and that's his heart song.
Right. His heart song. He sings opera to convince Brian to like come and help them.
He sings an aria to convince the elephant seals to come help them after like a very, very tense interaction where Brian is threatening essentially to kill both Mumble and Eric.
Yeah. Get out of here while you still can.
And then Eric breaks out into an aria and convinces them to, you know, be better, to back up so that you can go forward.
It's quite powerful. It's ridiculous. And there's a lot of like stupidity in the movie too.
Oh yeah.
But I mean,
Ramon and Loveless.
Ramon, who is just like horny.
He's horny and bumbling.
For voluptuous Sofia Vergara voiced penguin, like hot penguin lady.
Which, right, and once again, we have like this narrative of the man who's chasing the woman who has said no a lot.
Yeah,
like a lot.
The Ramon stuff is kind of a problem.
It's not good. And then he convinces her of his love by nearly killing himself to be next to her, which is just a bad narrative. It always has been a bad narrative, and now like. Through the 2022 lens, we have, I think, a better vocabulary to describe how bad a narrative it is.
And the movie does offer, like, there are healthy romantic relationships.
Oh,
like
yeah,
the counterpoint
of Mumble and Gloria,
who are just like, they have a good thing, right? They have a good, trusting relationship, and they're able to, like, articulate. Like, she's able to tell him, like, hey, man, you got to be a better dad. You can't just be telling the kid how to be. Like, you fucked this up. You got to go fix it with
him. And with also then the caveat that, like, yes, you fucked it up, but I think you're a good father. Like that's a healthy relationship.
It's powerful.
Yeah.
As a dad who fucks things up sometimes. It's
yeah.
It is cathartic when my wife tells me, she's like, yeah, you're pretty good at this. You know, don't fuck it up sometimes, but you're doing a good job.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love it. Once again, this movie is one in a quadrillion for me.
It is one in a quadrillion.
It's great.
It's so weird too. All the soundtrack choices.
Oh my God.
I mean, when they do Numa Numa.
Oh, I had forgotten.
You forgot about when they do Numa Numa.
I cheered when they started do it. Like I was in my house alone watching this movie, drinking mezcal, and
you weren't drinking this stanky. Bad molasses, cat pee, highly acidic wine?
I was not, because that evening I had decided that I wasn't going to drink very much, and so I would just drink something very nice in a small quantity, and I had this really, really nice bit of mezcal, and I enjoyed it very much, and I was on like my last sip as Numa Numa started, and my hands go up in the air.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck is even happening?
Yep.
It's Sven when Mumble has to leave to go get the elephant seals. He says, let me take over. It's a song from his homeland.
It's a song from my homeland. That was not a good, Hank Azaria, who, I don't know. I guess Hank Azaria's ridiculous, like, Nordic, Swedish accent is acceptable. Certainly more so than his now retired Apu accent is.
Right.
But, I love Hank Azaria. I think he's, like, probably one of the all-time great voice performers. This character is absurd and wonderful, and I love Sven so much.
Well, it's so much of a caricature of the accent so as to not even be the accent anymore.
Right.
And I mean, we'll put aside the fact that the band that did Numa Numa is from, I think, Romania.
I thought they were Icelandic.
No.
No?
No. They're from Eastern Europe, not from Northern
Europe.
What is
the name of that band?
So the song is actually called Dragosti Dinte.
That's right.
Numa Numa is the meme.
Numa Numa is the meme.
Essentially the chorus where the fat guy sings it and like dances.
Right. In his chair in his living room.
And the band is a Moldovan pop group called Ozone.
Ozone, that's right. But yeah, it's so funny how like these things age. Happy Feet 2 is 2011. I probably saw it around 2011, 2012. And hearing that song 5 or 6 years removed from like its memeified like peak of popularity,
which was 2004-ish.
2004, 2005. Yeah. I was just delighted and so excited to hear it. And then in last year's Sony Animation fucking masterpiece, Mitchells versus Machines, Numa, Dragos the Dente. Shows up in two different moments in the movie, but it's like this English language American cover of it. And it just like, I don't know, it hit me in a very wrong way, even though in the timeline of the movie, because like the first time you hear it, it's like a flashback where Kati Mitchell and her dad, who is, I guess technically he's like a millennial dad, like, but it's like their home video footage. And like, it makes sense in the timeline that they would have listened to it together.
Right.
But I don't know, the American or the English language version of it just like rankles me. And it just feels like, oh, you're just name checking a meme. But in this movie, even still today, I love it when that song shows up.
It's joyful.
Yeah.
It was so much fun.
And it's penguins.
It's penguins. Well, it's penguins being led by a poofin.
A poofin. A fraud. A poofin.
I am not a penguin. I am a poofin.
Yeah. There's, man, it's.
And he blows the little snot bubbles out of his broken beak.
Out of the crack in his beak every time.
Oh my God. It's so good.
It's super good. It's super weird.
This is another one, like, it's so disappointing, but not remotely surprising that the financial box office success was bad.
Yeah. Well, and I just finished reading this new book called Blood, Sweat, and Chrome by Kyle Buchanan. That's like an oral history of Mad Max Fury Road,
which we have shared on the socials.
We have. We should share it again. God, the book is so fucking good. Is like it? I read it in like a day and a half, which for me is extremely fast. This movie created problems for George Miller because this movie was released by Warner Brothers, who also just like financed and distributed Fury Road. And, you know, the old adage in Hollywood is that, like, you're only as good as your last movie, essentially. And, like, he was in pre-production on this or on Fury Road while they were developing this movie. For, like, a hot minute, he thought that he would try and pull a Spielberg. He actually, like, name-checks Spielberg and says, I was always so impressed by, like, 1993, Spielberg released Jurassic Park and Schindler's List at the same time. And then 1997, he released Amistad and The Lost World at the same time. And like, I would ask him, like, how do you develop two movies at once? Like, wouldn't you just be so totally overwhelmed and exhausted? And Spielberg said, you have to think of it as the one movie is a vacation from the other. So you work all day on the one, and then you work on the, like, you do pre-production or post-production on the other at night, and it's a break from it, and your brain can switch gears, especially if they're so different. Anyway, it's a long tangent.
I don't think that works.
I don't know. It's worked out pretty well for Steven Spielberg.
But like for any normal human.
Well, you have to be like a genius level once in a generation talent at the peak of your craft who will maybe never be equaled.
Correct.
Right. And George Miller is also one of those guys. But yeah, he thought that he could in 2010, 2011, this is back when they were going to shoot Fury Road in Australia, while he was finishing a Happy Feet 2, and everybody involved was opposed to it except for Miller. And then like, blessedly or not, as we've talked about, the Outback had like its uncharacteristic green season, like its most rainfall in like 110 years. And so Fury Road's filming got pushed back by like a year. And so Miller came in to this movie and he's like, all right, well, I guess I'm just going to work on this one by myself. And he had two co-directors who had been working on it under his somewhat remote supervision while he prepped Fury Road. And he was very unhappy with what he saw. And so for like the last 8 months or 11 months leading up to its release, he was much, much, much more hands-on. And Warner Brothers was not happy that the movie was a huge flop. And there are people who were involved in pre-production and the production who like spoke on the record with Kyle Buchanan and were like, oh, that movie's fucking garbage. Happy Feet 2 is so terrible and so bad, which fucking baffles me.
Which is just a bad take.
Yeah. I think it's funny the parallel between the two movies that like Babe is a better movie than Babe 2. Like, it's just more consistent, right? And I think Happy Feet is probably a better movie than Happy Feet 2. But I think Babe, Pig in the City and Happy Feet 2 are much more interesting. And the highs are so much higher than, like, the peaks of their predecessors.
I can much more easily say that Babe is a better movie than Babe, Pig in the City.
But yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'd have to watch them again. I'm much, much more familiar with the Babe movies because I saw them as a kid.
Yeah.
And I only saw Happy Feet and Happy Feet 2 like this past week.
But yeah, like what Warner's was like all over his ass because Happy Feet 2 cost them so much money and flopped so fucking hard, like everywhere. Didn't even make back its production budget, to say nothing of like probably $50 to $100 million in global marketing costs.
Guys, you should watch this movie.
You should watch it.
It's really good.
Watch it with your kids. It's really funny. And this is one of the things like that I like about the movie as a parent is it's like baby steps to introducing your children to the profound existential dread of climate change.
Oh my God. Yes.
With a scotch of optimism.
Yes.
Because the movie's whole thing is that like, yes, climate change is here. And it is inevitable, and there is nothing we can fucking do about it. Like, the movie literally gives you a global perspective, right? Yeah. Like, it zooms out to show you this iceberg that has broken off because of global warming, like, headed towards their community. Yep. It is unstoppable. It's here. But if we all figure out how to work together, maybe we can ameliorate the damage that it will cause.
That's a little bleak. But also, we have to work together. We're in this fucking situation.
Yeah.
There's no other option.
Yeah. You hear that, everybody? You got to keep recycling. That's what's going to solve it. Recycling. Do we have anything else to say about this movie? Do you have anything else to say about this movie?
I don't. I fucking love it. Watch it. I will be watching it again, probably like a bunch, because I had so much fun.
It's like, it's such a good time. Like, it's a musical. It's got great dancing. It's got more of that, like, that Miller. And like, especially doing the like computer animated movies, like you can feel his liberation in terms of like movement and physics,
yep.
Like the untethered way that his camera moves.
I mean, just a full zoom out to like the whole world.
Yeah.
You know, they're dancing under the Aurora Borealis and then suddenly you're above the Aurora Borealis.
Yeah. I'm getting chills just thinking about it. The cross cutting and the match cuts. And the way that they build to that like climactic conclusion to the final under pressure, like dance and song number. And they're people of the world unite. But then the penguins are dancing and then you cut to the underside of the glacier and you see all of the krill dancing and they're bioluminescent.
Oh my God.
And the way it's like radiating out and these like circle, like radial patterns that are matching to the rhythm of all of their dancing. Like, It's poetry. Like, it's a dumb, expensive studio jukebox musical dancing penguin movie that has visual poetry about connectivity and art and music and community. And it is like, it's so gorgeous.
And every moment of it is stunning. Quick correction of myself, like 30 seconds ago, it's the Aurora Australis in the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, this is the second time you've had to correct someone about an aurora in the last 2 weeks, except last time you were just being dumb because you don't know about things.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
But you're dumb and also don't know about things.
That's fair. All right, Jamie.
It's wine time.
It's wine time.
Wine o'clock. We've already talked about the flavors of this wine.
Which are myriad and bizarre, and I'm going to keep drinking it. I'm going to keep drinking it.
Oh, man. So
it's not grapefruit. I've got one more note here. It's not grapefruit, but there's some kind of citrus thing, and it's not lemon, although obviously like very sour citrus.
Yeah,
lemon.
I think it's lemon. Is it lime? Is it
no.
Yuzu? Have you ever
probably
had yuzu
not.
Juice?
No.
I like yuzu. Yuzu's good. It's got like a lemon slash grapefruit kind of thing going on with it, but it's very much its own flavor.
Maybe it is grapefruit. I don't know. I don't think it's grapefruit.
I really like grapefruits.
I am familiar. Anyone who is listening is familiar, and they're all like looking for the skip 30 seconds button to hit 7 times so they can skip the next several minutes of grapefruit argument. What? So let's do the pairing part first. Wines for kid-friendly foods.
Yeah.
This wine is fucking weird, and let's say conservatively that half the audience is going to find it alienating and unappealing. What kid-friendly foods do you pair with this lemon bowl of rancid cat pee,
well,
Jamie?
Well, really, thank you for that tee-up. I appreciate it.
I'm having another glass. Tell the people at home what chicken finger-adjacent product they should eat.
I talked a bunch about this wine being kind of analogous to sour beer. Sour beer and beer in general goes great with fried food. So like, for sure, fried chicken, but also fried mozzarella, You know, or mozzarella sticks as they are called, you know,
so, this French fries,
freedom fries. Guys, everyone, Scott is, I think he's contemplating what weapon he can use right now to murder me with.
No, I'm just like wondering why I'm doing this show with you. Like that is a, Jamie, that reference is nearly of the legal drinking age. Okay. That is some stale shit right there.
That reference is of the legal drinking age, isn't it? No, not until September.
It's not September yet, Jamie. Yeah. So, okay. So that's what you would pair for the children.
Yes.
What about for grownups? Like in a fancy ass restaurant.
In a fancier restaurant, I think this is like early courses. This is vegetables and salads. This is hors d'oeuvres. I think this with not that this is a fancy food, but this with like deviled eggs would be super good. You don't like deviled eggs.
I hate deviled eggs.
I love deviled eggs.
I have a strong and unpleasant sense memory association of any kind of boiled egg product. You're not helping out here at all. What about some roasted asparagus?
Roasted asparagus would be good. Also shrimp cocktail with this. The
acidity.
The interplay of the way ketchup and horseradish play sauce, I think would go really well with this. Also,
that sounds good.
Shrimp cocktail, one of my favorite all-time dishes. I just will order it all the time.
Shrimp cocktail is always good. It's always the best. It's the easiest thing in the world.
Yep.
Yeah.
I fucking love shrimp cocktail.
We're having some shrimp cocktail tonight.
Can we please?
I got a bag of frozen shrimp in there. I'm going to defrost that shit. We'll have some shrimp cocktail.
I love to hear it. So that's what I'd pair with this wine. A little bit of background on the winery and on the wine itself. Partida Creus is the name of the winery. The name comes from the crosses that are used to partition vineyards in this area of Spain, or have historically been used.
Crosses like crosses.
Yeah.
Like JC crosses.
Just used to demarcate the vineyards.
And they use crosses.
Yes.
Is this like from like an ancient Catholic tradition?
Yeah, probably, okay. But I didn't dive that far into that particular bit of context.
All right, fine.
I just know that they call it that because of that.
I mean, I feel like that would have been a good, useful bit of information to have to bring to the table.
It would have been interesting. You're right.
I read a whole book about a different George Miller movie just to be prepared to talk about this George Miller movie.
Right. You definitely didn't do that just for fun, for your own interests.
It was a really good book.
Partida Creus, founded in the year 2000 by Massimo Marchiori and Antonella Gerosa. They are a Piemontese couple.
Jamie. Jamie.
What?
There are certain things that our audience expects of you. And when you pick Italian wines, there are things that they anticipate.
This is a Spanish wine.
Then why are their names spelled like that?
They are Italian. They are from Piedmont, Piemontese.
Right.
And they are making wine in Spain.
Fine. Why don't we take another pass at their names, Jamie?
Massimo Marchiori, Antonella Gerosa. You jerk.
That's all I'm asking for. That's all I'm asking for. Please continue.
They are a Piemontese couple. They moved to Barcelona in the 90s to work as architects, finally deciding that they wanted to move out to the country to pursue a slower lifestyle. They chose the Baix Penedès, which is north of Barcelona. Baix means low, so lower, not like north to south, but lower in elevation. These vineyards are at about like 300 meters elevation as opposed to the other Catalonian wine that we had last episode, which is at like 600 meters elevation. That's south of Barcelona. They had initially just gone out to be farmers of like whatever local produce, and then decided that they saw a bunch of old vine vineyards that they were interested in rehabilitating. They also wanted wines made in a different style than they were finding, and so they decided to start making wine. Now we get into a story that I have told before. These are farmers who focus on old vine vineyards of obscure grape varieties in a largely forgotten place.
And specifically, another story you've gotten into before of people of one profession or discipline sort of stumbling haphazardly into being wine professionals.
That's correct. And certainly not describing myself in any way.
Well, we're not talking about you, Jamie. This
Can
is not
please
about you.
Talk about me? I love talking about me.
I know you do. I know you do. But
it's a theme that runs through restaurant and wine culture. And I think also beer and spirits culture.
Yeah.
Which is like, we just kind of stumble into it. No one as a kid gets asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And says, I want to be a winemaker or I want to be a sommelier. And then we find these things later in life because it's not a career path that we even really allow children to think about because they're not allowed to interact with the product, which I think is appropriate. But then they, you know, they get their degrees in architecture or in medical science or in whatever the hell else, or they don't get their degrees like myself. And they stumble in sideways to the alcohol business.
Like, you ever see Encounters at the End of the World?
No.
The Werner Herzog documentary where he spends like a few weeks in Antarctica and just like interviewing. He's not interested in the environment or the animals, although he does spend a lot of time with a like zoological botanist interrogating them about the idea of a gay penguin.
Oh my God.
But no, it's just like he's obsessed with like all of these people who just stumbled into living at the bottom of the planet. And there was the guy who's the janitor has like three PhDs in astrophysics, and they all just like end up in this place. And, you know, all these like weird, wayward outcast souls, essentially.
Yeah, it's really interesting to be in a field like that because everyone has such wildly different perspectives on what they're doing, but also like from their past. I think we all end up in wine, or at least like from the somm perspective, from the sommelier community, we all end up in wine because we are extroverted, or we are into performing, or we're really into the like the nerdy kind of cataloging librarian nature that can come along with being a somm. And those personalities all blend really, really well together. And then you get some outliers that are like, you know, I used to be a scientist and found out that I love wine.
George Miller used to be a medical doctor.
Right.
And then became a filmmaker who chronicled the physical bodily injuries that happened to people in car accidents.
Yeah, it's cool to see, you know, we, once again, as children, we're not modeled with that kind of, like, you can have a second career, or you can make a second choice, or you can make a mistake earlier in your life and find a career that's really rewarding. But when it happens to you, or when you do it, it's fun to be part of a community that empathizes with you, because we all kind of get there that way.
But yeah, like when the child is like, oh, I want to be a pilot, or I want to be a teacher, or whatever things that, you know, the child is interested in for 5 minutes at a time. It's like, yeah, man, you can do that. You can do all kinds of things, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have to just be one thing. You can do all kinds of stuff. He's like, well, I don't know if I want to be an astronaut or a dad. I'm like, dude, you can do both. You can do, yeah. American lives have second acts or whatever, which is, you know, bootstraps bullshit. But like, still, the sentiment has value.
It really does. And I wish that there was a little bit more of a model for it in media. I'm glad that you're modeling it for him in upbringing.
Well, we do what we can.
It's funny that we stopped on this because it's such a thing that I'm so like familiar with it on the day to day that it doesn't even read as bizarre or as a thing of note. Right. Like there are a few people who went to enology school and, you know, wanted to be winemakers right from the beginning. But those people are like almost the exception to the rule. A lot of the people who like came out of UC Davis in the 70s and 80s, who were the most famous and influential winemakers in California, they started at UC Davis for microbiology or for plant breeding, but in a completely different capacity. Like, what's her name? Kathy Corazon, who's one of the most important like figures in wine in the Napa Valley. Her becoming a grape scientist was at one point on equal footing with her becoming a lettuce scientist. It was just a matter of like which department within Davis wanted her. And it became grapes, and now she's the owner of Corazon Winery, which makes some of the most beautiful Cabernet that I've ever personally experienced. It's kind of wild, the like twisting turns that our lives take.
So enology is the study of winemaking.
Correct.
What is the study of lettuce growery? That's just agriculture?
Plant breeding. Is what her specialty would have been called.
I was hoping there'd be a funnier name for that.
Yeah, it would be nice.
Saladology. All right, please continue. That was a nice no. That's
that's salad writing.
Yeah. I want to fucking have a word with the saladographer who decided there'd be so many goddamn hard-boiled eggs in my salads.
I like hard-boiled eggs.
Gross.
I know. I know you don't
ruin
like
ruin a good Caesar salad every time.
They shouldn't be in a Caesar. That I'm with you on.
Yeah.
Hard-boiled eggs have no place in a Caesar. A Caesar is romaine and Caesar dressing and croutons and Parmesan and anchovies.
Tell it to all the people who like putting some fucking scrambled up egg in there. It's gross.
Motherfuckers.
Gross.
Anyway, these two, Massimo and Antonella, really concern themselves with small plots of obscure varieties, including but not limited to Trepat, Sumal, Garut, Quetchal de Lop, Oul de Perdue, and some so, as well as Subirat Perrant, which we have here in this glass.
Well, I don't have any in my glass. I drank three glasses now. I've had a lot. I don't know. Maybe I came around on this one.
I think you ended up liking it.
I found it very compelling. That's as far as I want to go. I found it quite compelling by the end.
Subirat Perrant is super interesting. I was doing some research on this grape, and I went to multiple sources, one of them being my big wine grapes reference book, and like general consensus, including from this importer and from these winemakers, is that Subirat Perrant is some kind of a Malvasia, which is an aromatic grape variety that can be found in multiple different countries under different names. But it turns out genetic testing refutes that. This has nothing to do with Malvasia. It just is called Malvasia sometimes in other places. And it's more closely related. It's actually a half-sibling of Pedro Ximenez, notable grape of Jerez, which makes sherry, which you love so much. So as I said before, this wine is 9.5% alcohol. As I didn't say, it's whole cluster pressed. It's bottled, unfined, and unfiltered. Scott and I didn't note, but the wine presents pretty hazy in the glass. It's not crystal clear.
But it's not chunkissy.
No chunkus, just haze.
Is there a word for that? I don't see any.
It's hazy.
Any place for that in Madeline's chart here in my Wine Folly book?
Well, that chart is mostly for like conventional wines that do get filtered and or fined.
Right. So they're
not going to put a box like chunkus, no chunkus.
Well, but okay. But so,
but if I wrote a wine book, I would have a checkbox.
Okay. So the haziness is on a spectrum with chunkus.
Correct.
So it's like chunkus is the one extreme, crystal clear is the other extreme, and hazy is in the middle.
Yeah.
So the haze comes from like micro chunkus. Tiny particulate chunkle matter.
That's our next t-shirt, micro chunkus.
Okay. We'll have to get that for bleep. He's a little micro chunkus.
He's a little micro chunkus.
With his tiny baby hands.
Well, his tiny baby hands and his micro chunks.
Oh.
Anyway, okay,
that's the haze.
The haze. It's hazy, and it's low alcohol, and it's funky, and it's weird, and I find it to be delightful.
I find it to be compelling.
But I
reluctantly
also
find it to be compelling. Like Jamie's just trying to talk over.
I am
because I've said enough about this.
You think it's compelling?
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you.
Which is my backhanded compliment. But I'm reluctantly finding it.
Well,
compelling.
this is that feeling of being very interested by it is why I latched on to wines like this when I was buying wine at Micah specifically, when I was really getting into natural wine. Because these don't taste like anything that I've ever tasted before, and I found that to be exciting. The thing that I didn't know is that a lot of natural wines end up just tasting basically like each other, and that, I think, gets very boring very, very quickly. And the crowd of what I call natty boys out there who just want to drink wines like this and no other wines, I find to be really boring and really just interested in the hype. You know, for my purposes personally, I'm very happy to drink this wine. At $32, do I feel comfortable buying it for a restaurant wine program? Absolutely not.
And that's because of how alienating your patrons might find it?
How alienating my patrons might find it, how much I have to charge for it when I could find a similar style for much, much less money.
And that maybe people would like more?
Or one that tastes nearly identical that I could just spend $15 on and sell for $13, $14 a glass and still make money on, and everyone is happy. Whereas this is a by-the-bottle pour. This is not a thing that I can pour by the glass, and I have to charge $80, $90 a bottle in a restaurant for this.
And for a $32 bottle, you would charge $80 to $90.
Do you want to talk about cost of goods sold and how to run a healthy business and beverage program? Because we can do that.
No, I just want to talk about you like bilking your customers out of for triple the cost retail of something.
Yeah.
For something that you're just ordering, putting on a shelf, and then opening. It's not like you buy meat at a certain, you know, dollars per pound, and then someone has to prepare it in a particular way and then serve it to someone. Like when I order food, look, I know you have to up the fucking amount that you're charging it for because of overhead and because of loss and because once you open a bottle, maybe you're going to not be able to serve the rest of it if it doesn't get consumed that evening. And that's why you're by the glass and pricing.
Also because you have to pay for a thoughtful beverage director who understands the financial health of a beverage program. Also, you have to train your staff to be able to sell this thing to give people.
Inflation is, Jamie.
It's my salary.
That's 100% why my salary. We have to triple the cost per bottle is to offset your thoughtful salary.
This fucking guy.
Wow, Jamie. Wow. All right.
Or also train the staff in proper beverage service, in the ability to pair this wine with the food of the place, to choose this wine to make it appropriate to sell with the food of the place. All of these things come into beverage service. Mm-hmm. Scotty, too hottie.
All right, Jamie. I mean, look, you're just making defenses for management here, okay? You're making defenses for the man, for management. All right? This is what happens when I have several glasses of the wine during our show is that I get contentious and argumentative with you. Even more so than normal. I'm just saying.
All right, Steve Chalmers, just say
I'm
it.
Trying to, and you're interrupting me. I'm just saying, if you tripling the cost of a bottle goes into training the staff better, then maybe y'all management, Jamie, should pay those people better so that it's not customary for me to tip them to compensate for the shitty wages you pay them.
Okay, well, one of these days you and I will go through a profit and loss sheet and we will pull it apart and talk about all of the pieces and how they work within a restaurant on a weekly, monthly, and yearly basis. And maybe at the end of that, I won't have strangled you to death with my bare hands.
How much of the P&L sheet will I have to read to you, though?
I'm going to fucking kill you. We have to wrap it up. We're done. This episode is done.
Wait, we're done? You don't have anything else to say about this
wine? I'm done speaking about this wine.
I think I may have come around on it. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting.
Scotty Too Hottie is officially a natty boy.
No, that's not true. Maybe it's just that it's less chilled, but when you first opened it up, it was funky and repulsive and unpleasant. And I don't know, man. I don't know. That last glass,
you liked it?
I kind of enjoyed it. All right, everybody. It's been a full arc this episode. It's been a real saga. I didn't expect this either.
I'm shocked. I'm very pleased.
I'm shocked as well.
So, Scott.
Well, hang on. So I guess we front loaded with the pairing, but
yeah. So, and I, okay, sure. Pairing.
I'm going to stand by what I said before. I think it pairs fairly well with the weird and dark and the sourness of Babe 2. And I don't think it pairs with the exuberant fruit forwardliness of, I told you that these movies were fruit forward. This shit is not fruit forward.
And
at
I
all.
Told you at the beginning of this episode that vintage to vintage, it's basically impossible to predict what's going to happen in the bottles of this wine.
I mean, that sounds like excuses to me.
It is an excuse.
Okay. All right. Fine. Do you think this pairs with Happy Feet 2?
No, I think this pairs very well with Babe, Pig in the City. I think that I enjoy the wine, so it's fine to drink with Happy Feet 2, but I would prefer probably like, I don't know, like a Sauvignon Blanc that's more like aromatic for Happy Feet 2. Something with a little bit more joy in it.
That one has a lot of joy.
Yeah.
Babe has a lot of joy too, but that joy is tempered
by drowning a dog. Almost drowning.
But not drowned. All right. So this wine that I have come around on pairs with Babe 2, does not pair with Happy Feet 2. Irrefutable conclusive decision here made by the both of us. So now, Jamie, in terms of the pairings, you are now 2 for 4.
Yes.
For the miniseries.
That's correct.
Last time you successfully paired with Steven. We found the funk paired with the weirdness of Steven.
That's right.
But not Teen Titans Go. And this time we pair with one of the two George Miller, ostensibly children's film sequels.
I think the next one's a good one.
So next time we continue with parental guidance suggested. And we're doing 2 stop motion animated comedies from the old world, Jamie.
God damn it.
From the old world.
You fucking colonial colonizing.
I'm not a colonizer.
You are a colonizer.
I'm not a colonizer.
Look at your face in the mirror.
Okay. Ethnically, I'm a colonizer. Okay. I don't even want to make this defense, but like my fucking impoverished Scotch-Irish like ancestors who came to this country were not colonizers.
They were pretty well oppressed when they got here.
They were thoroughly colonized by the British, as was much of the world.
The British are the fucking worst.
They're not great. Anyway, I only say that to antagonize you. These are 2 stop-motion animated comedies from
Europe.
The first of which, a longtime staple in my household with my child, Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit. A 2005 beloved stop-motion animated comedy from Aardman Studios is currently streaming on Peacock. That's yet another streaming service. Jamie, do you know what Peacock is?
And Peacock is the NBC one, right?
In the NBC Universal streaming service, soon to either be merged, consumed by, or dissolved when its parent company goes under, because the great streaming boom is where there's about to be some major casualties. Anyway, it's streaming on Peacock as of this recording and on VOD, wherever you can get them. I highly recommend it. And also, this one's a little bit more obscure. We are pairing that with A Town Called Panic.
Village au Panique.
That's right. It is a Belgian, internationally financed, but Belgian and French language stop-motion animated comedy based on the Belgian TV series, A Town Called Panic. That is currently available to stream on the U.S. on both Canopy, which is a streaming service that we've mentioned on the show before, and also on Ovid, which is a streamer that focuses on documentary and international films. Ovid right now has a 7-day free trial, and y'all should check it out and maybe keep paying for it as well. But watch A Town Called Panic, which is delightful and weird. And that one, if you don't want to do the trial, you can rent it on VOD through Kino Now. KINONOW.
And on the wine side, I chose... Well, a wine from the old world.
He said it. I didn't say it. He said it that time. That was him and not me.
It's true. It was me and not him. We're doing Bodegas La Senda, meaning the path or the way. They're 1984 bottling from Bierzo. This is 100% Mencia vintage 2018, available at despañafinewines.com for $23.
So the wine is called 1984. It is correct. Not the 1984 vintage.
That's correct.
So it's the 20 what year vintage?
2018.
2018 bottling of 1984.
Yes.
Terrific.
And by the way, I did some searching for why the wine is called 1984 and came up completely empty-handed.
Awesome. Great. Tune in next time, everybody, for more half-assed research from Jamie.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this episode of You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. Follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Please email us with any comments, concerns, or questions at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. And also, please tell every single one of your friends whether they want to listen to you or not.
What if they want to listen to us?
Well, then you should definitely tell them about us.
But they'll only know about us if you tell them.
That's correct.
This episode was produced and edited by me, that's Scott Hudson, and our social media presence is thanks to the fine works of him, that's Jamie, Jim Jamborino, Harrison Rubin, III. Our new art, it's not even that new at this point, that you're all enjoying, is the work of Ross Kennard. Thank you very much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies, it's good for you. We fucking promise.
Wow, it's getting sassy there at the end.
A little saucy.
They say never forget. I think you've forgotten.
I've forgotten. No, I've not forgotten about any of it. I just think that the Freedom Fries part is the funniest part.
It's pretty funny.
Freedom dressing, freedom kissing.
That's what we can do. September, we'll do like a 9/11 miniseries because 9/11 can drink now.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
This is a terrible idea.
That's a really bad idea.
It's kind of funny, though.
I mean, what are we going to do? Like,
there are so many 9/11 movies that we could do. I already have a short list miniseries of 9/11 movies.
I mean,
that was going to be a weekend-long marathon in Delaware. I have my list of 9/11 movies.
War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds, for sure.
Right.
Is a 9/11. I mean, you could just do a Spielberg 9/11 miniseries between War of the Worlds, Minority Report, Munich.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, it could be a compelling miniseries.
It's a great miniseries. Yeah. It would just be a gigantic fucking bummer.
Colossal bummer.
Yeah.
Huge, massive bummer. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this wine, maybe.
Enough about 9/11.
Enough about 9/11.
Let's talk about wine and children's films.
Oh, my God.